This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore.
So, any news on the latest in 3D printing?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Like, do you want to see it?
Sure, why not?
Okay. It's not all prettied up or anything.
In the meantime, while you get that, I'll bring people up to date. So, we just passed... Well, you get that, Ben. Did you know we just passed our 1 millionth all-time download?
Oh, yeah?
Podcast download, that's right. And that excludes YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Remember starting this a couple of years ago and we thought, wow, if we get like maybe 100 people a month, it'd be pretty cool.
Well, what even, I don't even know what the numbers were at the beginning of this year. How many downloads were we getting per month?
I think it's about 50,000 per month. At the beginning of the year, now it's over 100,000 a month.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Pretty crazy.
Anyway, show us what you got.
So here's the most recent design that we have.
It's your BattleBot.
Can you see
the blade? Yeah.
It's all
out of focus.
Out of focus. Anyway, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Do you actually fight with them?
Not yet, because I don't have a battery put together for two bots. And plus, like this one's still missing some components. But I've got one more component to design and print for that one, and then I'll get a second battery, and then we'll have a battle. Maybe I'll film the battle and we can include it in an episode or a portion of it, not the whole battle. It's probably too long.
So news in our household, my daughter finally decided to go for a fake tree.
Oh.
We've been going to the local grocery store here, aside from Lennoxville, Quebec, small town that's pretty well known now for raising thousands and thousands of Christmas trees. Anyway, so it was a local farmer that we knew down there that used to come up and sell them at the store in our neighborhood here in Ottawa. Anyways, they didn't come this year. I don't know why, but they're not in town. So Anna said, let's go get a fake one. So we did that. And so she did a little decoration behind me. You can see little very fancy decorations for Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I see them there.
Yeah, very fancy. Anyways, other news on the community site. Angelica got us some new electric blue little hoodie like I'm wearing. And we also have red, but apparently it's coral is the color. Not true red, but it's coral. And yes, you're right. None came in your size yet. They're coming. So Ben's still in the gray. I've got the new blue one.
Oh, they're coming. That's good.
Yeah, they're coming.
I thought when you said that they didn't have that size, that just meant it didn't. We didn't
just back ordered something. Anyway, so we've gotten a bunch of orders in. So go check out the new colors online. Anything else you want to mention on the community board?
Community is up to 728 users now, which is pretty cool. And there's a ton of, I mean, over the weekend, I couldn't keep up at all, but there was so much thoughtful discussion going on. I'm impressed every time I check it out how positive, intelligent, and curious the conversations are. It's really it's a cool place to hang out on the internet. I like poking around in there.
Yeah. I wish I had more time. Had someone ask on YouTube what kind of gear we use. So you and I now have the exact same gear set up. So I put it in the YouTube video from last week. Maybe we should put that somewhere on the community board as well, because I think a bunch of people were interested. It's a pretty standard setup now for a lot of people that do this, but happy to share. People can drop us an email as well if they want to know.
Yep.
Anything else?
No, let's go ahead to the episode. Welcome to episode 127 of the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Yeah, so we'll kick it off this week with a great interview that our friend Ted Seides did of our other friend, Shane Parrish. And as many listeners know, Ted operates the Capital Allocators podcast. And Ted was actually a guest of ours back in episode 61. Anyways, he interviewed Shane. Shane's based here in Ottawa. And he was also a guest with us in episode 19. And he operates the Farnham Street blog and also the Knowledge Project podcast. It was a really interesting, wide-ranging interview about Shane and his background. And it's kind of funny to hear Shane being interviewed as opposed to the interviewer. Talked a lot about his background, how that led him to creating Farnham Street, why and how he gets who he gets as guests, how he interviews them, his decision-making process, how he learns from reading, removing blind spots and how he thinks, how he invests. Talked about living through the pandemic and how it's affected him and his team and how he manages priorities at work and at home. And there's a really neat discussion about things that he likes and doesn't like and how he operates each day. So he tries to put a lot of automatic rules into his life to, as he describes it, reduce the decision load on him. And he finds that when he puts a rule in place, no one argues with your rules. But he says, sometimes people argue with your decision. So example he gave, he says, I never have meetings, I believe, before noon. That's my rule. Well, once it's your rule, everyone's fine with it. But if you say it's your preference, you decide not to have a meeting, people typically will try to challenge him. So he says, as soon as he changed his decisions to rules, end of any sort of debates.
Do you know where that showed up for us? Is in the leverage stuff. Because when we were talking about, when we talked about leverage, and it kind of kicked off the knowledge that for people that this is a thing that exists and that you can have higher expected returns and everybody gets all excited.
Yep.
We started having a lot of conversations with clients about it. And in a lot of cases, we were trying to tell people, we don't really feel like this makes sense in your situation. And we're getting a lot of pushback. And so we decided, let's build a framework to make this decision. So we made, I think it was 6 very specific quantifiable criteria. And every time somebody said that they wanted to use leverage, we went through the criteria, and it was ratios like income to the debt service ratio, loan to total net worth, loan to investable assets. I can't remember what else there is in there. And now when it comes up, we just, boom, here's the maximum amount of leverage that we are comfortable based on our framework with you having. And the conversations are so much easier.
Yeah, it's a great comparison, and so true. The next piece that I came across this past week, I just finished the book by Seth Godin called Practice Shipping Creative Work. And I've read a lot of Seth Godin's book in the past. It's always been about marketing. The one that really stands out for me was the book called Purple Cow that he wrote quite a long time ago. It must be, 12 or 15 years ago, which talked about standing out much like a purple cow in a field when you bring your product or service to market. Anyways, this latest book, Practice, is a very, very different book. It's inspirational. It's basically about everyone simply working on your craft, doing your best, most creative work, and putting it out in the world, and then to just consistently work on improving your craft. Just do what you love doing, do it regularly, fight against any sort of imposter syndrome you might be suffering from, and just enjoy that the ride, as he calls it, the ride of creativity. He talks about how today's society is so outcome-focused and not enough people appreciate the process to get to the outcome. It's so outcome-focused. And he says so many people are going down, his observations, people are going down these predetermined paths to get to some sort of predetermined outcome as opposed to really enjoying the process that you're living to get to what your outcome will be. And he highly suggests that people early on in their lives define themselves as a change maker and just find that craft that you're going to continue to enjoy honing to get to what will be your ideal outcome.
Very cool. I have one other thing to chime in on your notes about Shane. When you talk about automation and eliminating decision fatigue.
Yep.
And I know some people aren't going to like this because someone mentioned in the Rational Miner community that when I talked about having our meals delivered, his wife liked the idea so much that he feels like he's going to go broke now because she wants to do the same thing. And this is about that again. That's one of the other things that's awesome about it is that it eliminates not only the work of actually preparing food and deciding where going to buy the ingredients and things like that, but there's no discussion about what you want to eat. Like, you get this thing delivered and it's labeled, you know, Wednesday lunch.
Dinner.
I don't even have to choose between the two because they give you your lunch and your dinner and your breakfast all at once. You don't even have to choose between the meals that you get. It's like it's labeled dinner. Oh, good.
It's part of the magic of Costco, right? Limit the choice and make it high quality.
Right.
A quick news item, TFSA limits for 2021 were announced. $6,000 again for 2021. So the maximum lifetime limit is now $75,500 if you were 18 years old back in 2009.
It's getting up there, right?
It is. I remember when it came out, thinking, it's such kind of small amounts of money and lots of paperwork and stuff. But yeah, it's real money.
Yeah.
The last little news bit that I had was something I saw in the Wall Street Journal on the 22nd of November about Tesla's addition to the S&P 500. And they go on to say, this shows why indexes are so weird. So finally, Tesla was accepted into the S&P 500 index. As you probably know, it's the seventh biggest company in the US by market cap. And I did not know this, but it was rejected in September, even though it met all the qualifications of being profitable for 12 months. And that's something that our guest back in episode 54, David Blitzer, the now retired chairman of the S&P Index Committee, talked to us about all the inclusion rules that they have come up with over the years.
The inclusion rules and the committee that sits down as a group of humans deciding whether or not, regardless of the criteria, I mean, the criteria have to be met, but sitting down deciding who's in and who's out.
But you just imagine this transaction that's going to have to happen on the reconstitution, because there's right now about $11 trillion of assets benchmarked to the S&P 500. And the article talks about how the addition is so large that the reconstitution in December will have to have the car company added in two different chunks. I'm not sure the time frame between the two periods, but it's going to have to be done over two periods of time for the reconstitution.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And I saw another article talk about, well, which category will it go into? Technology? Consumer products? Industrials? Like, what will it be? And I don't know. I didn't get that answer either.
Hmm.
Now, you want to talk about small caps?
Yeah, I do. On the S&P 500 note, though, that we talked when we were talking about technological revolutions a few episodes ago, that example specifically of the S&P 500 index going back to whatever it was, I think 1957 in that example, in Jeremy Siegel's book. And he was showing that if you just never rebalanced and held the original companies and the original industries from back then, you would have beaten the actual index. And he kind of alludes to this potentially being the reason why, is that when does a company get added to the index? Well, when its price has gone up a bunch recently. And we're seeing that in maybe an extreme case here. I don't know if there have been other examples this extreme in the past, but the market cap of Tesla shot up so much in such a short period of time. And then boom, now it gets into the index. It's like the growthiest growth stock.
It's up sixfold in price this year. And it's up 25% on the news of the inclusion. And it's trading at 100 times 2021 forecast earnings.
I should have bought some in January.
We should have.
So small caps, there was a paper that came out in the quantitative special issue of the Journal of Portfolio Management that came out in November. And it was a paper looking at small caps, again, the size premium. The paper's called Settling the Size Matter. It's a really good paper. Unfortunately, the Journal of Portfolio Management is subscription. So it's not like SSRN where anybody can go and access the paper. A lot of it rehashes information that we already kind of know, which is and confirms it in the US and internationally, that there is no standalone size premium. So that's not really new, although it is interesting to see it confirmed again. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the first time I've seen it confirmed in a paper internationally. Most of the papers tend to focus on US. So no standalone size premium. Okay. That's interesting. And then it digs into more. So we also know from the paper that AQR did in 2018, that size does matter, according to that, when you control your junk, as they say it. So when you control for the junk stocks within size, and junk is sort of low profitability, high asset growth, high priced stocks. So when you control for that and own quality and short junk, there is a size premium. But this paper split those up into their long and short legs to see where that premium was coming from. And they actually found that it was only coming from the short side. So if you're long, high-quality small caps, there's no statistically significant premium. It only comes if you're short, junky, small caps. And then they did something really interesting that I haven't seen done before. And this is what made the paper interesting enough for me to want to talk about today, which is that they ran regressions on the academic factor portfolios. So people may or may not know this, but in the Fama French factors, they construct them as 50% large and 50% small. Now, that's a little bit strange because in the market's more like 90% large and 10% small, like by capitalization.
Yep.
But the factor portfolios are 50-50, so they're effectively overweight small caps. So in this paper, they said, what if we ran regressions on the academic factor portfolios using a market cap weighted factor portfolio? So we're going to see how well the cap-weighted factor portfolio explains the returns of the academic 50% small cap factor portfolio. And they found that it explains a lot of the returns, the market cap weighted portfolio does, but there are statistically significant alphas on the factors. So what their finding was, and the interesting point here, is that even though, and we've kind of said this before, but it hasn't been said quite as well as they did in this paper, all of the factors except, I think they found, except profitability in the United States, all of the other factors had additional alphas, additional unexplained risk-adjusted returns by overweighting small caps. So another way of saying that is that the other factors are quite a bit stronger in a way that produces a positive alpha in small caps. So their takeaway, and this is similar to the takeaway that AQR had in their 2018 paper, but again, it was just interesting to see the breakout by factors. Their takeaway was that a long-only investor may well still want to overweight small cap if they're tilting toward other factors being value, profitability, investment, which show up as stronger in size. So it's pretty interesting. And I also found that the takeaway that being short the junky small cap stock is the only way to get a standalone size premium. That's one of the things that Dimensional's changed in their investment process fairly recently. I think that's the most recent change that they've made, is excluding what AQR would call junk. So they've got these full exclusions in the Dimensional portfolios for small cap growth stocks, which they've been underweighting for a long time, but then small cap growth stocks with weak profitability. Now the most recent one they've added is small cap with high asset growth. So small caps are investing aggressively. And based on this research that we're talking about here, cutting those out is a pretty big deal in terms of capturing any semblance of a size premium.
Cool.
I thought it was pretty cool, but it also makes you think how important it is to be looking at multiple factors. Like if you're just looking at one thing, there's a good chance it could look meaningless. Like size is the example we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's been true for value too. Like you could, the Fama French paper last year showed that there was no statistically significant value premium in their out of sample period after their 92 paper. But meanwhile, if you combine value with, well, size, like we're talking about here, the premiums do come back and become statistically significant.
And that was a news story. And for the record, Ben had no notes on that.
I just read the paper and I thought it was interesting enough to talk about.
It's impressive. So now let's jump into the real portfolio topic. Everyone's favorite.
So I have a video, a Common Sense Investing video script that I wrote a while ago on dividends.
And I haven't read these notes yet. I haven't had time. So I'm flying blind like the listeners right now. So
I wrote this, I think it was around after I did the last video on dividends and saw all of the feedback and comments and everyone defending dividends and why they do matter and all this stuff. And I think
you got included. Your video got included in others' videos on YouTube.
Yeah, that one caused a big buzz in the dividend investing community.
You got hammered pretty good.
Yeah, I think it was all pretty baseless though. Which is one of the things we're talking about today.
But they enjoyed it.
Yes. Yes, they did. So where my head was at when I wrote this video was that one of the main points that pro-dividend people latched onto was that the theory of dividend irrelevance from the 1961 Miller and Modigliani paper is basically a bad theory. And they attack the assumptions in the theory to say why it doesn't make sense to base anything on this theory because the assumptions are so ridiculous. And it's stuff that's perfect information and costless transactions and nobody impacts prices when they trade and all that kind of stuff. I think I have somewhere in these notes all of the assumptions written out. The approach that I took in writing this was thinking like, let's dig into what the theory actually says. And to be honest, I don't think that before I wrote this, which was a while ago now, before I wrote this, I don't think I was that well versed in what the theory actually says. Like it's easy to say, well, dividends are irrelevant because of this paper, but the paper's pretty mathematically dense and I hadn't taken the time to really get it and walk through their examples. So I did that and wrote this and then just never recorded it. And then there was a discussion in the Rational Minder community recently about why only stocks that pay dividends should have value And so I dug these notes back up to jump into that discussion and then remembered that they were actually kind of interesting. So now we're talking about them. The goal of Miller and Modigliani in their paper in 1961 was to show that it was to prove what investors actually capitalize on when they buy a stock. Theoretically, what would a rational investor be paying for? What are they basing the price on when they buy a stock? Is it dividends or is it profits? Or another way of saying that is, are dividends relevant to the valuation of shares? Which is where the theory comes from. Now, one important note here is that they didn't say in the paper that dividends are irrelevant, period. It wasn't like dividends are irrelevant, see you later. They said that dividends are, the dividend policy is irrelevant to the valuation of shares given investment policy. Now, that's important. And it's another one of the big assumptions they make, actually, is that everybody knows what a firm's investment policy is. How much of their profits are they going to reinvest in projects? And you can kind of see the connection to the investment factor here. That's high asset growth would be firms that invest aggressively. And one of the main points that they're making here, and we mentioned this in a couple of episodes ago when we talked about the Gordon growth model very briefly when we were talking about the rational story for high prices and technological revolutions. I said that the Gordon growth model implies that investment policy, the Gordon growth model implies that investment policy and dividend policy are the same thing. And that assumption comes from the idea that financing is only internal. So in the Miller and Modigliani paper, they refer to this as the special case of internal financing. But then they also go on to say that that's not a realistic, that's not the only case that exists in the world. Firms can finance investments from more than just profits. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we think back to that example, a firm that has profits, the profits can be used to pay dividends, or they can be used to invest in projects. And the capital for, if a dividend is paid, given an investment policy, the capital for projects would have to be raised somewhere else, like by issuing new shares or taking on debt. And in the paper, Miller and Modigliani take on both of those cases and show mathematically why it doesn't affect the valuation of shares. If we imagine a firm, and they've got, these are just easy numbers here. So imagine a firm with $200,000 in cash, $800,000 in assets at market value, and no debt. And this firm's got 100,000 shares outstanding. Each share is worth $10.
The 200 plus the 800. Yep.
Yep. And the firm has opportunities to invest in projects or new assets or whatever. They know they want to invest, but they also know they want to pay the regular dividend that they typically pay. They're going to pay a $2 dividend. So in this case, the firm pays the dividend. So now it doesn't have cash anymore, pays the $2 dividend to all of its shares. So that $200,000 of cash that it started with is gone. But then it goes and raises $200,000 in new equity. It issues new shares to finance the investments that it had already planned to do. So the investment policy was given. They were going to make this investment regardless, and they just also wanted to pay dividends. So now these newly issued shares are going to dilute the ownership of future profits for the existing shareholders. But those existing shareholders also receive the dividend, which compensates them for the diluted value of their shares. And those shareholders, the shareholders that owned the stock before the dividend was paid, they've now got this $2 dividend and they've got an $8 share. The new shares needed to raise the $200,000 for the investment are issued at $8 per share, the new lower share price after the dividend was paid. So there are 25,000 new shares issued. So if we step back and look at this company, they've now paid a dividend. They've got $200,000 of cash available to invest in their project, and they've got $800,000 in other assets, and they've got no debt. Same as before, pretty much. But there are now 125,000 shares outstanding. The value per share has dropped to $8 because the cash was paid out as a dividend. If you owned 4 shares, again, just keeping the numbers very simple, if you owned 4 shares in the company, your ownership of the company's future profits drops after the dilution, but you could take $8 in dividends, $2 in dividend per share. You could take your $8 and purchase another share at the new $8 price. which would take your ownership of future profits back to its previous level. And that's, you can see right there, there's an investment decision that the investor makes at the point when a dividend is paid, which some people argue is a good thing, because a dividend investor might argue you can take that and reinvest in an undervalued company, as opposed to letting management dictate where the cash goes. And so I guess we kind of just see that mechanically happening here. If that company had not paid the dividend and they had financed the project with profits, so this is the internal financing case, the investor would not have received any dividends. They would have continued to hold their 4 shares worth $10 each, and their entitlement to future profits would not have changed. So in both cases, the shareholder is completely indifferent in terms of wealth and expected future returns before taxes are considered. The only difference in the two cases is how the returns were distributed to you, dividends or capital gains. But you can see walking through the numbers that given investment policy, dividend policy should be irrelevant to the valuation of shares. Because a dividend can basically be, I mean, not a trick, that's not the right thing to say, but a company has profits, they have their investment policy, that's what should dictate the quality of a company. A dividend can be faked, is not the right thing to say. It's not the best signal of expected returns. I mentioned the Gordon growth model, where all financing is internal. So that's assuming that investments can only be financed with profits. And that's, like I mentioned earlier, that creates the assumption that dividend policy and investment policy are the same thing, which in reality is not true. I think the math, that's one of the bunch of mathematical proofs they did in the paper. That's the one that's probably easiest to understand. But for any other case you can think of, they go through the same proof. Now, this is based on the assumptions that markets are perfect, where no trader is large enough to affect the price on their own. Everyone has equal and costless access to information. There are no fees or taxes. Investors behave rationally. Investors prefer more wealth to less wealth and are indifferent between capital gains and dividends. And they assumed perfect certainty, and this is a big one, where investors know each company's future investment plans and profits. So we don't really know all those things. Although with the empirical evidence that went into the Fama French 5-factor model, we do have pretty good proxies for investment, for asset, well, past asset growth tends to be a good proxy for future asset growth. And current profits tend to be a good proxy for future gross profits. So we don't know with certainty what those are going to be, but we do have pretty good, at least statistically meaningful predictive measures in those numbers. So I think where this gets really interesting is that when we take the Fama French 5-factor model and look at where it comes from, like the 5-factor asset pricing model is, it's an empirical model, but any time that you're creating a factor model, you have to choose what factors are going to go into it. So different ways you can do that. You could use like a machine learning algorithm, for example, and find the best fit model to the data. But in terms of predictive power, you wouldn't expect that to be very good out of sample, because there's no theoretical reason for it to continue. In the case of the Fama French 5-factor model, they used dividend policy irrelevance to build the valuation equation that informed the construction of the model. And because of that, I think it's pretty interesting to look at how well the 5-factor model explains differences in returns, including looking at regressions using the 5-factor model on dividend portfolios. Because if the model didn't explain dividend the returns of dividend paying companies, we'd expect to see big statistically significant alphas, which is something that we don't see. So Fama French took the dividend discount model, keeping in mind in that model, dividends are relevant. Dividend policy and investment policy are the same thing. So with the transformation based on dividend irrelevance, you quickly see that profits minus investment divided by the discount rate is what we should actually expect to dictate a firm's value, given the theory of dividend irrelevance, given the theory that investors capitalize on profits minus investments, not on dividends, which I think mathematically has to be true, as you can see from the example that we walked through a minute ago. Fama and French then divide that by book value of equity so that you can scale the metrics in the equation by book, and that spits out the predictions of the 5-factor asset pricing model. People may be familiar with the predictions already, but it's worth just mentioning them. The first prediction that the model makes is that if you control for expected profitability and investment, firms with a lower price relative to their book value have higher expected returns. That's the value effect that people are familiar with. The second prediction is that given price relative to book value and expected investment, higher expected profitability implies higher expected returns. And that's the profitability effect. And then the third prediction is that given price relative to book value and expected profitability, lower expected rates of investment are associated with higher expected returns. And that's the investment effect that people tend to be a little bit less familiar with. Now, on their own, each of those effects has strong empirical support. Like all of the papers leading up to the 5-factor as a pricing model showed strong empirical support for each of those factors in isolation. But the cool thing is that, and I think it's cool just because it's all tied together with the valuation framework, the theoretical valuation framework. When you combine all those together, the 5-factor asset pricing model is able to explain the vast majority of differences in returns between diversified portfolios. And we wouldn't expect that to be true, I don't think, and I'm not a statistician, but we wouldn't expect that to be true if investors were capitalizing on dividends as opposed to profits minus investments. So it's not a proof. I mean, I don't think you can prove anything in finance, but it definitely offers support for the theory of dividend irrelevance to the valuation of shares. And I think one of the practical implications for investors that's really interesting to think about is that even if you're picking stocks, like people that say, well, I pick, you know, good dividend paying companies, one of the practical takeaways from this is that it makes a whole lot more sense to look for companies with robust profits that invest conservatively, which clears away the muck of dividend policy, which shouldn't actually tell you a whole lot, because dividend policy given investment policy is just a financing decision.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're an ETF investor or a dividend stock picker or whatever, it makes more sense to look at profits minus investment, gross profitability minus the growth in book value of assets. That's a better metric. Now, it's harder to find, I guess. Maybe that's a problem. If it's easy to find dividend history, and there's so many websites dedicated to dividend history, if you wanted to find the gross profitability and growth in assets for a company, that might be
has the same emotional cachet as saying it's a dividend growth payer.
It doesn't have the same emotional cachet?
I think it has huge cachet. Having a profitable company with low investment sounds great.
Yeah, it does. It does sound great. And it gives you better, cleaner insight into what's actually happening inside the company. Because you think about the example that we gave earlier, we gave an example of two hypothetical scenarios, one where a dividend was paid and one where it wasn't, but it's the exact same company with the exact same expected return. The fact that it paid a dividend didn't tell us anything. Another way of thinking about that is excluding that company because it didn't pay a dividend, assuming it's got favorable overall characteristics, would also not make a whole lot of sense. And this is the crux of the discussion on dividends. You're excluding companies that may otherwise be good investments for reasons that aren't necessarily sensible. I also wanted to just talk about, and this came up in the Rational Minder community discussion too on this topic actually, where people like Kevin O'Leary or anyone, like you take any, you know, there's a lot of famous, well-known investors that say, like Kevin O'Leary says in a quote, that you should only invest in dividend paying stocks. By the way, he's got, I don't know if they still exist, but he had funds and ETFs that only invested in dividend paying stocks. So mind the conflict of interest there. But I think people like that saying things like that, and maybe this is obvious to the people listening, but that doesn't make dividends relevant to the valuation of shares. If anything, and there was a paper on this, I can't remember what it was titled. I know Larry Sweater wrote about it a while ago, though. There was a paper showing that if there is a preference for dividends, well, it's kind of like the ESG tastes stuff that we've talked about. If there is a preference for dividends, you would expect that to drive up prices and drive down expected returns. I don't know how strong the evidence for that preference is, but if you want to make that argument that people like dividends, okay, well, that should mean based on a taste for dividends, you've got lower expected returns for those types of stocks. This is how I think, but I think having the theoretical framework to think about these things in the context of some theory. So in this case, we're theorizing that markets are efficient. That's basically the big assumption here. And then evaluating things from that perspective, I think that makes quite a bit of sense. I also think it was useful to go through, to go through the theory of dividend irrelevance and see like, what were these guys actually talking about? And what were they actually saying? Because the holding investment policy constant until I really read through the paper is something that wasn't necessarily obvious when you hear the theory of dividend irrelevance getting thrown around fairly casually. Yeah, so that's it. Given investment policy, dividend policy is theoretically and empirically irrelevant to the valuation of shares. I hope that example, walking through the company that could have or could have not paid a dividend, but maintained the same exact characteristics, same expected return, same assets, different share price, but same wealth in the hands of the shareholder, just a different distribution of the wealth. One argument that's interesting that I've heard made is that in that example that we just talked through, if the firm has to go out and raise capital, there may be more due diligence applied to them. So in the internal financing case, there's going to be less scrutiny on how they're investing their profits. Whereas if they go to raise equity or debt, there's going to be an underwriting process and there's going to be more people looking at what are you guys actually investing in. I think that's an interesting argument. I think for that to mean that dividend paying companies have higher expected returns, we're again assuming that markets are inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting point to consider.
So companies that would be scrutinized less would have higher expected returns?
No. Well, no. I think if a company is doing less than ideal stuff with their profits, investing in, you know, bad projects or something like that, I think that there's a bit of an assumption there. If we're saying that the expected returns are going to be lower or the realized returns are going to be lower, there's a bit of an assumption that the market is not correctly pricing in the fact that that company is doing less than ideal stuff with its profits. But if you're sitting there looking at the market, looking at prices, if there's a company that's not paying a dividend and investing in suboptimal projects, you'd expect that to be reflected in the price. And to say dividends are beneficial because they take that away, I think we're assuming that the market wouldn't be pricing it correctly.
Got it. Anything else to add?
No, I think that's all for the portfolio topic.
So let's go on to the financial planning topic. So this is a discussion paper I came across in the most recent edition of Wiley's Financial Planning Review. And the article is called Financial Planning, a Research Agenda for the Next Decade. So it's an interesting 7-page discussion paper that looks at, as they describe, the challenges, opportunities, and future of research and practice in the field of financial planning. And they kick off the article just by defining what financial planning is. And they describe it as a collaborative process between a client and a financial advisor that integrates relevant aspects of the client's financial and personal circumstances to maximize that person's ability to meet life goals. I think we'd all agree on that. And they said it's also felt to be the process of financial planning provides the context for behavioral change related to a household's financial situation and a delivery system for family economics and resource management theories. So financial planning can be defined as applying economic theory to everyday situations, such as the concept of mental processing or bounded rationality, replaces the notion of perfect rationality with all of its inherent limitations. The roles of cognition, biases, heuristics, and framing illustrate the growing importance of employing behavioral finance. So there's a really neat chart, almost like a Venn diagram, that shows 8 interrelated fields of financial planning. So hopefully we get these in the show notes, but they basically, the 8 fields of financial planning start with behavioral finance, consumer financial decision making, consumer protection, policy and regulation, financial therapy, literacy and wellness, household finance, human sciences, portfolio choice, and lastly, psychology and human decision making. So I would suggest, Ben, these kind of describe our lives day to day.
Oh, without question. And we've mentioned, I think, in a few past episodes that we've been doing a lot of work internally on the financial therapy and wellness piece, but I guess it ties into the psychology and human decision making, just to help people make better decisions and help us communicate with people in ways that help them make better decisions. It's like you can have really good information, but if it's not being communicated well to all of the stakeholders, I find that when you think about this in the household finance context, it's easy to think about a single do-it-yourself investor that's doing a great job managing their portfolio. They've got index funds, they've got whatever. Maybe they don't need life insurance and so on and so forth. Maybe they're saving a bunch of their income. But when you add a second person, like a spouse, for example, into the mix, it makes it so much more interesting and it becomes more of a burden to make all these decisions well and to communicate Like if a spouse doesn't understand investing at all and they ask, you know, why are we invested in index funds or should we be selling to cash because of the COVID crisis? You know, that's not easy.
But it's also, as you said, do-it-yourself investing. Well, investing is only one of these bubbles.
Right. I'm just talking about the portfolio choice piece. You're right.
There's so much more to it than that. Anyway, so of course, there's a survey in here. So they gathered data from two different surveys, one from the 2020 Academic Research Colloquium, which is the academic research meeting for financial planning. And then they also gathered data from the Center for Financial Planning survey, 2020 survey. So a lot of key participants in this industry chimed in with some thoughts. So what they did, they identified the following as the most significant research done in the past decade. So the topics were behavioral finance, financial literacy, risk tolerance, and retirement income planning. So we've certainly been active in all of those subjects. So for the next decade, here's the five key areas that will, as they put it, help unite financial planning researchers in a way that will significantly improve the lives of individuals. So number one, technology. And we completely, hopefully I'm accurate speaking for you, completely agree that technology will have a huge impact for households just to manage finances. They allude to robo-advisors, machine learning, artificial intelligence that can help with portfolio management, risk management, retirement planning. We've seen some very impressive tools that are coming, software to automate a lot of the financial planning, you know, for large companies. So you can see there's a whole wave of fintech coming that will help with a lot of this.
I'm a little bit skeptical. I think that a lot of it is going to improve the productivity of humans. If you think about maybe the robo-advisors as an example, they've got a nice interface, which is hugely important because people can easily understand what's going on in their account. But I mean, what else can they automate or use technology for? I don't know.
I'd love to see a better job of tracking real spending. Like a lot of people have a hard time knowing what they spend, and to be able to easily, like now I know you can upload and you can do things with a variety of different platforms, but it's not easy or as easy as it should be. Number two, the topic is client behavior and psychology. Things like behavioral nudges, investor psychology, client communication strategies, changing behavior, and as we talk about all the time, helping clients make better decisions.
I think one and two go hand in hand. Having better technology is probably the best way to implement behavioral nudges and things to help with psychology. Don't you think so?
Completely agree. Number three, retirement, decumulation, and demographics. So there's two main cohorts they talk about, baby boomers and millennials. So baby boomers, you know, need help with retirement distributions, estate planning, and long-term care. And millennials will need to focus on wealth formation and portfolio diversification. I'm not so sure there's that much needed on the portfolio diversification. I think there's a lot of information and research that is available, but clearly, and we're doing a lot of work on the first one for boomers, which is on retirement distributions.
Yeah, we have been doing a lot of work on that. That's been one of the really cool things about having Braden join our team is his ability to digest, because that research is dense, like mathematically. I mean, when Moshe was on, like that's his world. And he's, yeah, it's just on a different level of statistics and thinking.
Number four, impact investing, environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG, and social responsibility. They talk about a social and environmental consciousness. As that rises around the world, it'll become more important to understand and model what moral values people care about and their expression in investment policy and performance. So they talk about a need existing to extend impact invest, ESG, and social responsibility topics to the individual, to the family, and to household.
I'm skeptical, as you know.
We know. Number five, ethics. There's been much work done by consumer advocates and policymakers to constrain unethical sales behavior. And that's something that Michael Kitsis talked a lot about with us when he was on. But they talk about an ongoing need for ethics research in the categories of professional ethics, ethics of knowledge, optimal decumulation, definition of intelligence, choice architecture, and investment selection. I wish they had more details in each of those bullets. They did not. They were just giving us bullets.
Oh, okay.
So in terms of opportunities that they see a chance to broaden financial planning beyond serving only the higher income households, and perhaps technology can help with that. More inclusion of behavioral insights into financial planning and raising awareness, I thought this was interesting, of retirement planning tools and techniques And they specifically said annuities in there.
Hmm.
And that's something we've talked about very often.
Yeah, and it's something that fits right into the decumulation piece. That's one of the things that we've been working on, that Braden and I have been working on, is a better tool to communicate how annuities fit into asset allocation.
Yep.
Because it's hard to communicate and to show. And it affects other decisions. Like if you did allocate to annuities, your portfolio withdrawal strategy might be and probably would be materially different.
Okay. Is that good?
Yep. I think that's good. That's an interesting paper. And it's interesting to hear a lot of that stuff. Keep thinking about the conversation that we just had with Josh.
Josh and Brian.
About the need to not be rational in investment decisions. I still think it's important to start from a point of what a rational person would do and talk yourself out of it based on other considerations as opposed to just do whatever feels good. But it is interesting to see this opinion on where financial research is heading, financial planning research is heading. Because that's one of the things that Josh said in our conversation was that the era of the theoretical perfect portfolio is dying, and portfolio shaming is dying. And it's, you know, you just do whatever feels right. That this kind of speaks to that.
Without being too crazy, he did say that.
Right.
He said, diversify, low cost, low tax. He said, yes, you have to do that with most of your portfolio.
Right. It's kind of what I said, I guess. Start from what is rational and talk yourself down from it.
So for bad advice of the week, I know it's kind of the same theme. So you're going to want to take this and make sure we turn it into a lesson. But it comes from the website, A Money Marketing. And the title is In Defense of Active Management, October 5th, 2020. So the point of the article is that not all markets are very efficient. I took aim at an article written by our friend in the UK, Robin Powell, argued in an article prior to that the markets were in fact quite efficient. So the author argues that the markets are very efficient in developed markets. However, and I quote, for smaller companies, there is limited or no analyst coverage, leading to pricing inefficiencies that stock pickers can exploit. More broadly, they continue, I find it illogical, even churlish, to think that the active fund management industry is based on quack technical analysis of companies and economics is entirely useless and offers no value. Ergo, any outperformance is down to luck. I don't get why a fund manager should invest in terrible companies that are basket cases just because they happen to be in an index. In life in general, we choose the good and reject the bad. So why not with stock selection? After all, the global economy and global stock markets are highly discriminatory, rewarding certain companies and sectors such as technology and healthcare, and eschewing others like banks, oils, and other value stocks. Why should the latter have to be included in portfolios if their outdated industries are offer little or no shareholder value? Okay, Ben, lesson in there.
Well, it's to an extent kind of the line between active and passive gets really interesting here, because a lot of the things that he's saying aren't that crazy. To say that global stock markets are highly discriminatory, rewarding certain companies and sectors such as technology and healthcare, that's kind of true. And it's one of the reasons that we don't necessarily think that it makes sense for everybody to own a cap-weighted index. Like when you tilt away from large growth and towards small cap value, you're decreasing your allocation to technology and healthcare.
But the line, I don't get why a fund manager should invest in terrible companies. Someone has to own every company.
Yeah. Well, a terrible company, that the lesson there is that a terrible company is not necessarily a terrible investment. In a lot of cases, terrible companies can actually be pretty good investments. It ties into the conversation we had about technological revolutions and declining industries actually having really strong stock returns in a lot of cases. It's an estimation errors issue. People tend to think things are going to be worse than they actually end up being, which means that you can collect the value premium. That's a behavioral argument for value anyway.
But when you realize that someone has to own all stocks, even a terrible company, what would it take for you, Ben, to put down your cash to buy a terrible company?
Right, which is why that's the estimation errors argument, for sure. It's a bad company, so you're not going to pay as much for it, which means your expected return is higher. That's that distinction between a bad company, which there are lots of, and a company with bad expected returns, which the biggest one is small cap growth stocks. Those are the one type of stock that has really bad expected returns. Small cap growth or IPOs, which tend to behave like small cap growth.
So you'd be glad to know the author does not dismiss the use of index trackers, as he uses them occasionally, but quote, the best evidence I've seen for passive fund outperformance is where markets are steadily rising. For example, during the golden decades of the 80s or 90s, or after a global financial crisis where central banks pumped large amounts of money into the system, pushing up asset prices across the board. But in contrast, where markets are moving sideways, are volatile, or falling, index tracking seems to be a very poor investment strategy.
I mean, for this one, you've got to ask, okay, show me the evidence, because I don't see any paper citations in here. Yeah, no, not a lot of data there. So show me the evidence that's true, because I can show you the evidence to the contrary.
Well, he answers that. He says, the active versus passive debate is more complex and nuanced than some would suggest, and those who dismiss active fund management outright are ignoring some key evidence.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, what is active management really? Like, I think it comes down to, because you can argue that using dimensional funds or Avantis funds or tilting away from a cap-weighted index, you could argue, I wouldn't agree with it, but you could argue that's active management. But then the question is, why are we saying that the cap-weighted index is passive? Or why is the S&P 500 passive? The S&P 500, as we talked about earlier, has a bunch of active decisions going on and what gets included and what gets excluded. So who gets to decide what is passive and what is active? And can we definitively say that active is bad? Well, it depends on the definition. If active means tilting away from the cap-weighted index, then no, it's not bad. If active means timing the market and holding a concentrated portfolio with no evidence-based reason to do so, yes, that's bad. But there is this surge of awareness of passive / index investing and how that's different from active investing. And now we're at a point where people kind of get that passive is good and active is bad. But we're also at a point where I don't know if people understand what they're saying when they say that. I don't even know, like, does it even make sense to differentiate between active and passive? We have a guest coming on early 2021 who's done some really interesting research on how indexing is basically, calling index funds passive doesn't make sense. Adriana Robertson is her name. And she even argues, I think, in one paper that index providers should have to register as portfolio managers because they're giving investment advice by creating indexes because so much money is tracking them. And it's interesting to think about who decides what is passive. I mean, that's a total digression from this.
Passive is such a loaded word too. Well, so is active. They're loaded words. Anyway, so that was a great explanation.
I think that's the key though. Is this a good investment strategy? Is it low cost? Is it broadly diversified? Is it trying to time the market? If the answer is no, that's probably good.
Is it rules-based?
Yeah. Is it rules-based? Can you increase expected returns? Yeah. Is it tilted toward some of the known risk factors, which would be a good thing? Those are all reasons to invest in something. I mean, you could even argue that we talked about Maurer a while ago as an active manager. They're relatively concentrated. So I think that's a strike against them, but they're also low cost and relatively low turnover. So how bad are they? Maybe not so bad if you really want active management.
I agree.
I think it's when you get into a lot of market timing and high turnover and super concentrated portfolios, or alternatively, I guess, high cost diversified portfolios. Like if you're paying a high fee to own an index, a closet index active fund, that's also not ideal. But maybe is a closet index fund that calls itself actively managed really just a passive index fund? I don't have the answer.
We'll leave that thought-provoking question for the listeners. Anything else?
That's good for this week.
All right. Thanks for listening.